We'd introduce it, so I'm new to satellite.
Audio galaxy.
He has it.
But I'm laughing the next day
because he
downloads
it every night. Everything that everybody like got from. Yes, lovely. Keeping down average stuff that's
yeah. Charlie, could you prefer
not
to be here?
No, I love you being here. So, Commissioner Prescott.
Yes, sir.
Here we are, December 1, 2001.
Actually, 30th.
Today's the 30th. Hey, November 30th.
Yes.
I'm a day ahead.
Yes. December 30th.
And the headlines of the paper are bringing your tenure as commissioner towards a close with great fanfare.
As I entered.
As you entered. And you have been asked by the Minister of Security to make a report. So that sometime in the next period of
week or so, yeah.
There will be Colonel Prescott's report
yeah.
to the Minister of Security on the rehabilitation program.
Yes, there will be. Actually, I've given him a preliminary report on the specific incident, and to just do some review now, to his satisfaction, for him to understand what we do in rehab and what our approach is in rehab. There's nothing that I think everybody understands fully, the whole approach. And so in another week or so, I will definitely submit this report to him. And basically to inform him again, to edify him, educate him, let him know what we're doing and why we think this way, that he can be part of the team fully, because he's new. And I understand fully how his head is now. So we're going to be doing that for him. And I think I'm preparing a tenure as commissioner PowerPoint presentation, plus another presentation, just to bring him really on board, to make him understand why we have taken this approach.
So allow me to focus this interview on 3 points in time.
Okay.
First point in time is when you first came in as commissioner. I'd like you to tell me what it looked like. What was your initial assessment of the scene and your initial reactions to what you saw?
Okay. I was in the JDF as a military officer, serving as the commanding officer of a battalion. And my chief of staff called me quickly and said, listen, you have to go into the prison services and sort it out. At that time, many headlines in the papers, the staff was bombarded with negatives, a lot of violence, the systems were just not working at all. And that was headline. If there was an escape, even if it was in a minimum security facility, because it made headlines. I was sent here for 2 years to sort out things. When I came, I was in shock. Although I had previous experiences coming in as a military officer to deal with strikes and all sort of things that occurred from time to time. In fact, earlier I did a paper to show that our presence in the service here was really one that they should examine, because we had officers who could be at work to do the work, but they were either off on a weekend at the races, absent for no real reason, and it was creating a staff shortage problem. And when I presented that, I remember distinctly that within a week they were ordered to be at work. And we were taken out. Of course, as a soldier, I don't want to be inside that prison environment. I'm not trained for that. So that was the first contact. But when I came in, I was in total shock with the conditions that I saw. I saw squalor, I saw dirt, I saw indiscipline. I mean, everything that was contrary to any military environment that I was accustomed to. And really in shock. Shock is the only word I put to it now. So I decided that set about to clean up the place. Literally, clean it up. Get it clean and tidy. And allow for persons to present themselves in uniform. Just get back the basic things that lends a uniform group. I spent the first 6 months really listening, going along quickly to look at all of the facilities. Persons were saying to me, you know, this is the first time they've seen the commissioner visit institution. And I was in uniform. I was in not military uniform, I was in my commissioner's uniform from the first day. When I had my meeting with senior staff, I was in uniform. So I think that created a big impact, especially I was going around with a helicopter and Christmas time, it was about Christmas time, so landing in different places, helicopters. I would get anything at that time, anything. If I asked for $1,000,000,000, I would have got it. So I was really on a swim. But luckily for me, I saw the sense at that time to really listen, because I couldn't imagine that persons and morale could have been so low. And from there, 6 months, then I started to put a plan in place to get a common focus for the department, because I had no mission or mission statement. We spent about 3 months doing that, at all levels, at retreats, just bringing the staff in, going through things like values and how they look at the department and how they feel about themselves working in this department. And we came up with three strong values that we still now have: integrity, commitment, professionalism. And those three form the core, I think, of how we looked at a mission for us. And then we formed our first mission statement, and we had our vision statement. I introduced a thing called total quality management, which we got when I was first exposed to it in the JDF by a Canadian. And I brought her in, and she actually did a retreat, and that was very good. You know, doing things like first time type of thing, and paradigm shift, and demonstrating the whole thing. And that really helped to make people start feeling, well, you know, we are better than what people are saying we are, and we can do better. And I was very pleased that we could accomplish even that change in attitude of the senior staff, middle management. And then I got into things like looking at pay structure, organizational structure, and we did a lot to get increases in pay. Very significant too, because in that year when we had the highest increase ever recorded in salary for staff, was a year when only 12% was given to everybody else. We had 80% increases.
What year was that?
1995.
And you came in as commissioner?
93 December. So 1 year was spent, and then by next year, they had this thing. But significant. We've also had significant changes in how persons' appointments and promotions and all these things were done. You know, setting up standing orders. And basically what I did, I took the files from the military. I just put a structure temporarily to just feel some order in the place. Standing orders, rules, regulations. And I found that even reading the past inquiries that went back for how many years since 1975, they spoke to all the ills, all the the things that needed attention in the service. And really, nothing was done to action it. Mm-hmm. Now, I always viewed myself as somebody, as an action person, not a speech maker, going along talking. Let's get into it. That's me, infantry, true blue. So I came and I said, well, here are all these inquiries, and what I'm trying to do is not just to put them in place. Go down the list, see what is to be put into how to do it, because sensibly, what they said was sensibly, we proposed all the different reports. Suddenly, yes, we were moving along, and then there was some conflict that started, because I've never had to deal with unions before in this way. And somehow I found I couldn't be honest, I couldn't be truthful. I was prevented from trying to be truthful and open. I brought in the press, I in fact had them show visually to the public, to make a public, what has happened, and said, we need help, volunteers, that time. I opened everything, communication lines, everything, and that was a big move, because people, it was a closed curtain, iron curtain, couldn't get into the system at all. And I found that the inmates loved this, because more and more they were getting communications out, people were actually listening, and they saw where, I suppose, I listened to them. I had meetings with them, one-on-one, and we would discuss, and I would put things in place based on our discussions. So I would get letters, and I have stacks of it. This is happening, that is happening, we need this, we need that. And they would put their names and everything, so I knew who they were eventually. Initially it was just anonymous. But the staff somehow developed strong resentment, whether directly or through the union. I suspect it was through the union, because I had a head-on with the head of the bigger union, who we worked well in the first year and a half, when all the things were happening with pay increases. And just to tell you, I was the first commissioner to sit at a pay negotiation with the union, side by side, when in fact you would picture me on the government side. And I don't know, something happened. Maybe I challenged my position. Challenged it. And I just said, well, listen, all I said simply in that meeting, I remember it distinctly, I am the commissioner. And he said, you think you are in charge? I am in charge. In other words, the power belongs to me.
What precipitated that?
It had to do with a matter that we were discussing with the Ministry of Finance, to do with either salary or promotions or something related to the staff. I can't remember clearly how it came up, to be honest. Not right now. But to me it was a very simple matter, and I had to say, well, for administrative and whatever, I'm responsible for that, not anybody else. And then I was shown, or told then, in front of his 40 delegates, he's a child. It has just not been good from then.
He said he was running the system in front of 40 people?
Of his own delegates. In other words, I didn't understand it then, but I understand it now. It's a sure thing, a power. Sure. I used to have officers who used to leave here, senior officers, when something should occur, that he should report up the line to me. He goes straight to the union. And I had to bring them in and say, listen, if you ever, ever do that again, you are fired.
What was his position?
Who was that?
Lambert
Brown? Yes. Well, that was the one at the time.
Lambert Brown?
Yes.
But was he on the staff, or was he
related? No, totally.
He worked for a union.
Union, that's it. And his membership occupied 80% of the membership of the correctional system. So I suppose he felt, you know, and I had to put my foot down, because for ultimate responsibility, I found that I'm the person answering questions. If somebody is curious, if this is happening, I have to answer. I'm the person who has to go to Parliament and answer. So, you know, let us get it straight. If we have a problem, we discuss it. In fact, I was up to allowing for open, cooperative type of union management thing, because I've read, you know, even on our course where in the Japanese system we have union and so forth, right? So I'm all warm to that, and I believe in that kind of strategic stakeholder alliance, you name it, for cooperation.
Well, that leads to the second point that I wanted to focus on,
yeah.
Which is the strike. My understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that there was a point in time at which the union took the guards out on strike, and a crisis point, in a sense, was reached where the union wanted you to step aside,
yes,
and to reassert its power.
Yes.
And tell the story of
okay.
how that went forward.
It is not, in hindsight, what happened started as a, I would say, it was not started by the union. So the staff grumbled. There was unrest. They had some dissatisfaction. Salary, as usual, and allowances, work time, and some other things. They listed, there were 15 things that they listed, and I knew about that list. And one of it was that Commissioner Prescott should go. One of them. When they went off on industrial action, my issue was not the premium issue. It was not the top issue. But as soon as the union head got in, they used that as the top issue. So there was some level of deception, because when they discussed it with the union, they didn't have me as the top priority, but they presented it with me being the top. So a lot of persons who, after so many years, are now telling me that they were deceived, because they didn't think my going out staying had anything to do with their main interest.
Put it in the chronology for me. What, at what time did this strike take place?
The 4th of January, year 2000.
4th of January 2000.
Yes. So.
And by that, set the scene for us. By that time, where had the rehabilitation program come? What sort of progress had you made?
Yes.
What tensions had actually grown up that were brought to conflict by this strike?
Yes. We were, I would say, motoring on quite fine with the rehab. And the inmate population, as far as I'm concerned, were generally totally accepting the idea of rehabilitation. And I think the majority of the staff also accepted the idea of a rehab as against punitive. When this thing happened, it really cut into many of the activities that we were involved with at the time, programs and projects, especially outside projects, because there was really no staff to man these outside projects at the time. And it really made us lose our focus for a while, because we had to deal with this crisis. I had to be answering questions, and luckily the government backed the position and reconfirmed to me the way they presented themselves, confirmed that what we were doing was the right thing. And there was nothing that we were doing that was seen by the government as wrong. And also the inmates. Because, to be honest with you, if the inmates were enough for me, and they came out visibly, you know, and publicly to defend that no, he has to stay, type of thing. And I look at them as my clients, you know, because if you're selling a product and your client's not happy, then you know you won't get any business. But if your clients are satisfied and your boss is satisfied, come on, let's see what you guys are really saying, you know. So I took the view that, okay, well, if you want to go, that's your decision. But I warn you that if you stay out, further consequences. I sent that out to them as a warning. They ignored it. The boss came, Lambert Brown again, and said, well, we are out on industrial action and we are not coming back to work until government decided to take once and for all. Over the years there were always been these sort of cap strikes, once and for all to take action. And so they sent off all of them, 840 of them. 840 staff. They sent them off on leave, leaving a mere 200, 300 or 400 in the system to man and carry on. So we had to call in the JWS to help with security. At that time we had private security doing some things, and so it wasn't as devastating because the security was okay. It was just the rehab, skills training, schools and so forth. And then that, at that time the psychology, the thinking is that, well, I have to support my colleagues outside and I can't do too much to show that everything is fine. So I had to struggle through that time where I knew we could do it, but they had to show that it couldn't work. So we struggled for a while through that, and I think we have settled down a little better. In fact, we're doing more now with much more now with them outside.
Now, do you think it was part of the strategy of the union that without those 840 guards, there'd be trouble in the prison system that would require these guards to be back in?
Oh yes. They felt that everything would crumble now. I would buckle. We would just fold. I mean, there's no way that the government would see 800 persons in harmony saying Prescott is to go and not make this little man go and we come back. They were wrong and they didn't calculate it. Simple. And you know what made them so wrong? The inmates' population. I am telling you, it's nothing else that has convinced me. That's the only logical thing that I saw that would have kept me strong. That when persons ask individually, collectively, outside, you name it, why do you want to keep this man on? I mean, with all of what is happening, because he's doing what we know is a good thing for us. We see the benefit of his program that we have never seen. So that's it, simple. And they never calculated that.
And from the outside, from my viewpoint, this seems to me to be a critical point.
Yes.
In the story, because the guards walk out.
Yes.
They expect that in their absence, bad things will happen in the prison system.
Yes.
Riots, chaos,
yes.
Whatever.
Yes.
And it seems that at that point, the teammates coalesce and figure out that they don't need to play the part that the guards have scripted for them in the play.
Exactly.
And that if they don't play the part, that is, if they self-impose order themselves, that is, they become responsible as a community themselves, the guards lose power.
Totally. And they started to form committees. They started to show that they were willing to do educational programs, whatever. And I gave them a level of authority within the institution to hold keys to workshops, open up, control it, and literally ensure that their lives are not disrupted because of what is happening if we had a manpower shortage. And they took on that thing seriously. They saw the trust, they saw the level of care, and I would say, you know, to believe in them. And there were some key persons in the system. Desmond Green started something as early as 1994, and I watched it carefully. Because Desmond is not a, I guess you'd say, traditional manager type. He's more a visionary, philosophizes this, and he's, you know, out there, achiever. Yeah. And I had to balance going at that pace at the same time, ensuring that we had a structure to support where we were going. So I was pulled, you know, but yes. And I saw how you approached this thing, where one-on-one, constantly, in a counseling, mentoring approach, made the inmates start to think differently. They saw themselves differently. They were empowered, simply. And it struck me now that we brought in a consultant to bring some sort of sense to this thing, to understand what is happening, what is this rehab, what is empowerment, what does it mean to us, why should we be, and put some proper things in there to say this is our approach, a proper approach, because it makes sense again that if somebody is to benefit, when you have to make persons come on board, there must be a benefit to them. And I believe that that is what is the big difference. But it's not an easy change or process, because if you're actually saying to the staff, you're giving over the power to the inmates, and it's really not. It's not that. What you're really saying is, if I'm here to help you, I must know what you need. And I have to listen to what you say. Whether it's nonsense, then when you're finished, then I'll be able to say, honestly, that's nonsense. But if you don't listen, how are you going to know what my needs are? And just by sitting down and listening to the need, the man feels, man, at least I have somebody listening. And especially when you do something to act on what he has asked for, say that is his need, you just find that it's a different person you have in front of you. Suddenly his expectations grow. You put hope back into his life. He's now a firework that is going to give you 10 more things to do, and your work is just going up on us. But the work that you're doing, although more, suddenly you realize that you're operating in an environment that is healthier, more secure, and I could walk in any institution at any time, anywhere, even if there was a riot a minute ago. As I walk in, I have never had to be looking around in my back to see if who's coming to stab or never. And I remember distinctly, I've never had the escorts either, because they never used to walk around with me. They showed a lot of resentment. And so when I walked in, I felt safer than walking in Kingston.
And this is a very safe place.
Very safe. So I think that is what happened. And then many of the staff came on board, senior and middle, and they found that, in fact, this enhances their own security and enhances the security of the whole thing. And so tension went down, and a lot of things started to change just like that. But underlining what I found to be the constant heading is in discipline. We have not learned how to be disciplined and to be consistent with it. When it affects us, we say, well, discipline is required. But if it's not, then we try and get away with indiscipline, which is not good at all. And that's the thing that we're wrangling with. People just want to do their own thing. And this escape is critical. How can a man, I didn't know this, that there was something in my head that said, there is something wrong here. Totally wrong. Why would one man walk out of a prison environment with a classification, a high risk inmate? He alone. And you have tons of soldiers waiting to escort. If we're taking persons to hospital, 4 or 5 soldiers are there. I was there on Wednesday to book in my aunt. 6 soldiers with one inmate. And when I looked at the inmate, we sat down together talking. I said, so, well, that's the... And I noticed inmates, I mean, you know, if the sick soldier went to the hospital, he has, can hardly walk because he has some hernia thing or other. Sick soldiers. And then he decides, a healthy, strong inmate, walks out. He alone, driving a vehicle, he's the driver, and the inmate decided. Explain that. Something is not right. So,
explain. Go ahead. What is the story that you think
applies to this? Well, I was just told now that he's related to the inmate. But before I knew that, I suspect that because I was sabotage again. I've seen a lot of that.
Sabotage in the sense that
they're trying to, for instance, you're here. Two professors from Harvard to do this thing, and rehab is going to be boosted now. New minister, whatever, Russia show minister, that this thing is not put something in the scope. I've seen it. Every time that you move in a positive direction, there's either an escape or something happening. And when we investigate it, and I go in front of inquiries and the evidence comes out, it shows that the staff, again, but I always catch them because I have...
Staff again, finish the sentence.
The staff, again, is involved with negligence or corruption.
So the way you describe it, one can imagine a strategist on the other side.
Well,
that is someone who's
trying, still trying.
As soon as Prescott announces his retirement, now's our chance.
Ah, to get back to normal.
So who is the strategist on the other side?
I wouldn't even want to go there.
We have a panel discussion coming up.
Okay.
Tomorrow.
Okay.
I'd love to invite the strategist for the other side to sit on the panel.
Well, I don't know. And I would not say I'm put on record that I think that Lambert Brown or any union member is strategizing my demise. I wouldn't say that because I don't even think about it. I just keep doing what I know I have to do. But what I do is put the procedures and the processes in place, the orders, the standing orders. And I know that we have thought it through step by step. And if something occurs, I can now pin where in the line somebody did do what they're supposed to do. Boom. And I hit that person. Whether the person innocently overlooked or just failed to do their duty properly, that's it. They're going to get knocked. Right? And sometimes the persons who set them up for it is not caught. And I find that is so. There are a lot of persons who will appear to be with, but they're not. They're not. I've had that right up to my level. And I've demonstrated over and over. But I bring everything close to me. Everything. And I participate fully and open fully. And when it reaches outside, I know exactly where it's coming from.
All right, so now point number three.
Yeah.
The present. And let me confront you with a way of looking at it and ask you to respond. You have had the experience of eliciting trust from the inmates.
Yeah.
They've become teammates.
Okay.
And they've actually substantially diminished the old style power of the guards.
Yeah.
But yet this is a prison. And the roots of violent culture run very deep and have economic underpinnings.
Yes.
The cultural underpinnings. Yes. Anyone in Jamaica who has to give permission for something to happen is not acting outrageously within the frame of Jamaican culture if they somehow look to make a little for themselves in giving the permission.
Mm.
And when you start to pile that structure up, it gets to be the system that you saw when you first came in.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now you make the decision to retire.
Yeah.
And one way of looking at that is, all right, you've got the founder's problem. The problem of having started something that was very much a function of your personality coming into a situation and your energy making the situation change.
Okay.
But as the founder, you have the problem. What happens when you step out? Does it continue or does it fall back?
Okay.
And from the teammates' point of view, who've invested a lot of trust in you and supported you, they will inevitably be saying, why is he leaving us now?
Yeah.
Why is he leaving us back in the hands of the people who can reimpose the bureaucracy and the violence on us?
That's a very tough thing that was put to me, and I felt it from the day I made the decision that after 8 years that I should go. And I planned it this way. 2.5 years ago, we started the strategy, rehab strategy, with a consultant. And also, we did the change transitional management strategy training. And for 2 years, despite all the things that would change the focus on that, we pursued it. Getting the money, putting things together, really pursuing transition, change, succession planning, you name it. I've been watching within the organization persons that were qualified academically but needed some management training, exposure, you name it. And I've brought in persons from the probation arm that was doing well into the head office, threw them in a job. I mean, Aileen Stevens, a typical example. All she wanted was an opportunity to dig her teeth into something. She speaks my language, literally. When you speak to Mr. Ferran, he speaks my language, literally. Mrs. Jive has a track record of being a very caring person. But they're not John Prescott, and I don't expect them to be. But to me, I have to look at myself, my growth, my perspective now. I've brought a change, and I'm happy about it. But the organization needs to grow too. And one of the things that I found coming in 8 years ago was morale was so low because nobody felt that they could move up. The persons were always being taken from outside and imposed into this chair. It happened previously with a military officer. You know, so I felt, no, it's time for this organization to feel that they are capable of having one of their peers come up and lead the organization. I'm satisfied that we have two persons vying for that position. I'll give my recommendation of who I think at this point in time would be the better person to just head up this organization. The inmates is the particularly tough one because already I'm getting letters, already they're saying to me that if I'm going to leave. And all I say to them is, listen, I would not leave knowing that something is in place to continue. This rehab strategy cannot turn back. I've had the endorsement, and I think it's something that we've worked to get for the Prime Minister to say publicly that he endorses rehabilitation as an approach. The Minister, the Governor General, in fact, the Governor General next week will be launching our national rehab strategy at King's House. We hope to have the Prime Minister and the Minister and several leading business persons giving greetings. We had a meeting yesterday with His Excellency and everything is ready to go. So it's being positioned, it's being put on a platform that I cannot imagine. And he's the new Minister now. Even though we had this negative headline, he has said straight up in front of me, Director of Rehab and my deputy, that headline is wrong. He did not say that. He believes in rehab. And if you read the first line, that's where I am at. In other words, if there are schemes, projects, that you have persons going outside that are of this type to go out and endanger the public's life, with what is happening currently, then it has to stop. How could I disagree? Because we don't operate like that. I said, Minister, I showed him our file. I said, Minister, we have 20 projects. He took out his file. He said, we have 20 projects with 216 inmates. And maybe if I tell you who is out there, you might now get a headache. I don't want to go there. But most of them are ex-death row life. You know? So, that little thing, a little bit of a time. Because what has happened is inconceivable. What he's saying to me too is that he's concerned that when they go out, they get involved in discipline again. They are to go to point A, they find themselves at B. They are at point A, they know no visitors, why they are there. They find visitors coming to them and they invite these visitors to meet up and do their little thing. I've had to cut quite a number of projects for a while just to show them that, listen, you have to abide by the rules. You have to show discipline, you have to show strength. If I'm empowering you, you have to go through and show the public that you're different. Lessons to be learned. And so, with all of that, I don't see it being turned back. And I don't see myself in the sense of leaving. If something can be done to have me in the wings to influence projects or programs and whatever, I would certainly want to do it. But I'm not pushing myself, because I know the business too, that when you're out, you are out. And I don't want to be hanging over the commissioner who is going to be here to make them get the impression that they can't do the John Preston. No way. They're going to assert themselves and put themselves into place. So, I have this confidence. And I have this team being groomed for 2 years. If I had my way, I would have put somebody in here long ago and be monitoring for the 6 months. But the system don't allow for that kind of openness. You know, it's a little thing, and services commission has to do this, and they get applications, and you know, so we just have to play the ball. If I had my way, somebody would have been here 6 months from September, sitting, and I'm here sitting, going through, and that's a bit. You know, so that's how I would respond. And the inmates, the only area in the inmates is that a lot of inmates who initially were involved with this dramatic change process are leaving. They're getting reprieved, they're on parole, they're out of the system. And you would never get another set like this, because these are ex-death row. It is a different thinking level, educational level, ability. I mean, they are almost like scientists. Some of them, they have some serious minds. I mean, and they are strong, disciplined. They have a way to keep control over. And I've seen it already. A lot of the ones that are gone, I can see slippage, because they would hold things and get things going.
Yes.
In fact, there was a strong fear that these persons had too much power, and I had to deal with that too.
Talk to me about that. One of the things I'm most curious about is when I visited here last month, I was told that one of the measures of success of the rehabilitation ethic was that there were many fewer guns, knives, and drugs.
In for that.
In the prisons.
Yes, in for that.
And the question is, how did that happen? Who actually reduces the guns, knives, and cocaine in the prison? How does that work?
Well, I don't know about guns, but I know there's still cocaine, still marijuana. Still
marijuana for sure. I saw marijuana being openly smoked. No problem.
Yeah.
In fact,
well, it is a problem, but it's just that it's not being enforced properly. It's almost like a culture. People accept it. In fact, this morning we found one of the sentry boxes was searched. Sentry boxes, that's where the soldiers are. They found ganja and all sort of contraband in the sentry box. obviously is coming in. People are in business. People are in business, let's say clearly. Cellular phones, drugs, whatever, and they're getting paid. That's what's happening. Greed, indiscipline, you name it. So, you have persons in there that you would have to appeal to. And I remember having to sit with them to let them know that there are certain privileges that can be given. But if I catch anybody in this institution with cellular phones or whatever, you're going to be caught. You have to position yourself. They now ensure that certain things don't happen, or that they're not caught, let's put it that way, candidly. So it's done with some discipline. But you work with that slowly until they realize that they can do without these things, because the privileges that you're putting in replaces the need to have a cell phone. You get more visits, you get the weekend, you get telephone access because more phones. It might be slow, but you have to have the patience. So it's a matter of replacing what they used to have or do with something that is official, something that the management sees that is necessary. More visits, weekend releases, that means a lot to them. A weekend out where they're not even monitored or escorted, come back on Monday morning. We have never had anybody running away. Never. And we've had over 200-300 persons involved with this particular. So it shows me that if you give persons a level of trust using the instruments properly, they will hold up their end of the bargain. The parents, the relatives, actually bring them back to make sure that nobody kidnapped them, and they know what they're going to do, why they come with them. Because there are persons outside there that would want to exactly, and have them run off, invite them, entice them, so they come with them, place them there and say, okay, good, they're back in. It's a powerful thing that we've gone through with this thing, and that's the only way I see this thing working. The only way, and the big sense of it is simply, we have 80% leaving these walls within 4 or 5 years. They are going back out. It's my insurance. They could easily be my neighbor. Easily could be my neighbor living next door. I have to cope with it, and the community will have to understand that. So we need more community-based programs, more rehabilitation for the community to understand what is important with what we do and why we're positioned in this field. This is why I want to get the probation aftercare service doubled, so that they can do more prevention work, more social work with families and schools, you know, in addition to what we do now. It's so much more, you know, to do. I would never. Next thing is that I was not trained as a correctional person. I'm a military person, trained military person. Not that I can't do the job, but I think quite honestly, if I was in the military and reached this level, and I see somebody from outside coming to the chief of staff, I would feel badly about it. I feel bad. I want to allow for that to happen. I really want to allow for that to happen.
All right, Commissioner. Okay. Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you.
When to come here, Commissioner?
Yeah?
Where to come here?
Well, I was just to mention that I'd love to have an opportunity to develop some way, a text or a book. Call it that. An approach to rehab that I so believe is could be useful, not just for Jamaica, but Caribbean and whatever. But to develop that text or that book or that memorandum or something that is tangible, something that is really, that could be used to use in correctional management. Because, you see, the premise now, just as the courts have this premise of you having to swear to tell the truth, but they presume that you're coming to lie. The premise here is that you are here to as punishment. And to be punished too, if you behave badly, and not, you know, the premise is wrong. It doesn't need a flip of thinking, a change. And I think you get a different approach being introduced. Staff training, how they are oriented, when the Mesa received, how they are received. It's not a grabbing and grabbing. It's you're receiving a person, not a dead body.
Client.
You're receiving a client. That's it.